Thank you, Father Spratley. Thank you, Kelly, for inviting me to be with you again at this anniversary meeting. Last week I was in Texas attending the Texas Annual Convention of AA. And after the meeting, I spent a day or so with a friend of mine who has been a trustee of AA from Texas on his ranch. And I was reminded of a story they tell about a Texan rancher who came up to northeast section of the country in the Vermont, which is one of our lovely states, where the hills are high and the valleys are narrow, and the farms in general are small. But being a rancher, he wanted to see what a Vermont farm was like. So he went out to one particularly lovely green valley. He was talking with the farmer, and rather condescendingly, he said, "You have an awfully nice little spread here. It's very lovely. How many acres you got?" 127. But now, when I go out in the morning on my ranch and get in my car and drive out to Northwest Corner, I don't quite get there by noon. Yeah, I had a car like that once and I got rid of it. So up in damn Yankee country, we try to get even once in a while. AA is a miracle. And there are many individual miracles in AA. If you don't believe it, let's look at the record. If you were looking for the place where you would find the kind of wisdom that there is in the AA program, would you look for it in a couple of broken down drunks? And that's where it is. And as we think about what happened in AA and its development, and how God brought the right people with the right ideas together at the right time, Dr. Jung, world-eminent psychiatrist, who had been treating Roland, a wealthy American, for several months for his alcoholism, discharged Roland, thought as cured. Not long after that, Roland came back to Dr. Jung, drunk again. Dr. Jung told him, "I've done everything for you I can. So far as my help is for you is concerned, there is no hope. Once in a great while, I have seen people with this problem get well by way of religion." So Roland came back to this country and became part of a group mostly in the Protestant Episcopal Church known as the Oxford Group. And he found his sobriety there. And while there, Roland met Abby Thatcher. And Abby was an old drinking buddy of Bill Wilson's. And after he had found some comfort in this Oxford group, he called on Bill. It's the first time in many years that Bill had seen Abby sober. "Abby, how come you're sober?" "I've got religion." "Not you." Bill thought he was an atheist. Abby says, "Yeah, I've got religion in the Oxford group. And the way to handle it is to get honest with yourself. To pray to God, whatever your picture of God may be. Make amends to the people that you've harmed, and to carry the message to other people." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But Bill had his pitcher of bathtub gin on the kitchen table. He'd been told repeatedly by Dr. Silkworth, and Lois had been told also You can't stand many more of these binges. You just won't survive. But Bill kept on drinking. A couple of days later, went back into towns. Dr. Silkworth met him at the door. And I'm sorry, Bill, go on upstairs. And he went upstairs and began with the treatment. And the treatment included medication about every 2 hours because of the way in which the sedative effect of alcohol goes and the psychomotor agitation comes up. Bill was waking up every couple of hours, completely miserable, tense, frightened, depressed again. And he thought of what Abby had told him. And for the first time in his recollection, Bill prayed. And had a Damascus Road experience. He thought he'd gone crazy. But a great peace came over him, and he fell asleep. The first unmedicated sleep that he'd had in a long time. When he wakened the next morning, he still thought he had gone crazy. And when Dr. Silkworth came in, he asked him, have I gone nuts? Dr. Silkworth said, no, Bill, but hang on to what's happened to you. And within the next day or two, someone, and I don't know whether it was Ebby or Dr. Silkworth, who brought into him a copy of William James' Varieties of Religious Experience. And Bill read it and began to make a little sense to him. For several months after that, Bill tried to pass on to other people who were patients in town sanitarium what had happened to him. Nobody bought it. But Bill stayed sober, stayed dry. Dr. Silkworth had given to Bill a twofold analysis of the problem of alcohol. An allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. Now, in those days in medicine, we were taught that all disease had one cause. If you couldn't settle on one cause, you still must look for it. And it was rare that anybody really accepted the idea that a disease could have two causes, two aspects. As we said, nobody bought what Bill was trying to sell. But remember that Bill was a Wall Street promoter, a high-pressure salesman. And I think that this is one of the reasons why nobody bought what he was trying to sell with high pressure. Do you know the story? He went out to Akron on a business deal, was beaten in it, alone, bored, discouraged, broke. In a hotel in Akron, down in the lobby, pacing back and forth, hearing the pleasant sounds coming from the bar, tempted to go back in, but realized, thank God, that if he went in there and even took a glass of ginger ale, it wouldn't be long before he'd be back again. Realized that having talked with other drunks had kept him sober. He went over to the church directory and there were more than one notations of Episcopal churches in that directory. He picked one. Why did he pick that one? Was there a plan? But he picked the one that had an Oxford group in the church. Talked with the rector, asked him for the recommendation of a drunk he might talk to. And that pastor referred him to Henrietta Siebeling, whom he knew as a member of the Oxford group in that church, had tried to work with alcoholics. Henrietta Seeberling had spent considerable time with Dr. Bob, tried to persuade him that he couldn't take one drink, but Dr. Bob hadn't been able to live by that. Although he had accepted and tried to live by the four absolutes of the Oxford movement, absolute honesty, absolute love, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity. These I'm sure that you here in Cleveland and Akron know as a part of the AA program. Bob had tried to live by these, and it hadn't worked. But Henrietta had some loyalty from Dr. Bob, and when she called this Saturday night, Dr. Bob and Ann, and asked them to come to her house to meet this person, this man who had found an answer to his alcoholism, perhaps. Dr. Bob was drunk, couldn't come that night, but agreed to come the next morning. And they came. Dr. Bob had told Ann on the way that this would be only a matter of 10 or 15 minutes. He wasn't interested in talking to anybody. But they struck fire. And Bill took to Dr. Bob this twofold idea of what alcoholism was. But the twofold idea wasn't enough. But Dr. Bob and Ann brought the third leg of the stool, the three legs, the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. And Dr. Bob and Ann added the spiritual. Was this coincidence? I don't think so. Then Bill and Dr. Bob, after they talked for a couple of days, called the hospital to see if there was another drunk there that they could talk to. And they were told that there was one there, and they went up to the hospital and spent a little while with Bill D, who was AA number 3. And the next day, Bill D bought it. I wondered many times, what would have happened? Would Bill and Dr. Bob have had what it takes to continue if Bill D hadn't seen the light, hadn't accepted what they had to say? One of my early experiences with Alcoholics Anonymous was the first banquet that the AA groups in Rochester, New York held. It was in June, late afternoon, windows were open, apple tree in bloom just outside the window, the birds singing. I was sitting at table with a young couple who were fruit farmers outside of Rochester. The young man had been dry about 6 months. And he said, "Doctor, this year for the first time I can remember, I'm seeing the apple blossoms and hearing the birds sing." And what a dividend this was for him. And Bill D, in his talk that day, closed his talk with that wonderful prayer of St. Francis, which I would like to use at the end of my talk this afternoon. As we think about the other people that came into the picture, Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill's brother-in-law, was a member of a men's Bible class at Riverside Church, which is a Rockefeller church. And the teacher of that class was Mr. Willard Richardson, who was Mr. Rockefeller's advisor in his philanthropies. There had been some interest on the part of some of Mr. Rockefeller's associates in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Mr. Rockefeller asked Frank Amos, one of his close friends to come out to Akron to come to know Dr. Bob and Ann, Sister Ignatia, see what was happening in Akron, whether people were really getting well. And he came back to Mr. Rockefeller recommending that he purchase a hospital and endow it with $50,000 as a way of furthering this idea. And Mr. Richardson sent the message at the time that a number of Mr. Rockefeller's wealthy friends were meeting together in New York, sent the message by Nelson Rockefeller, because his father couldn't attend, that in his judgment, money and property would kill this thing because it was a spiritual movement. And that idea, together with the resistance of some of the people in the group here in Akron, accepted this idea that AA should remain poor, should not have money and property. And how fortunate it is that that advice was accepted. Another one of Frank Amos's contributions in the beginning was his understanding that a literature was necessary that would really effectively present accurately the AA program, and continued to urge Bill to write until finally he got the book written. But you know how the book was written. How Bill would ask people what they thought about this, that, and the other idea. He'd try these ideas out on a number of different people. And when he had clarified in his own mind through this kind of help what the next paragraph or perhaps the next chapter in the big book would be, he would dictate it to his secretary, Ruth Hawk. She'd make three copies. One copy would stay in the office. One would be taken apart by the group in New York. The other copy would be taken apart by the groups here in Akron and Cleveland, put back together again, sent back to New York, and the final copy would be created in that way. Of course, those of you who read AA Comes of Age realize that Bill says in that, I wasn't the writer, I wasn't the author, I was a referee. And as we think about how important this technique, this method of thinking through a topic with the ideas of a good many people put into it, how the validity of the book, of the ideas in the book, of the ideas as they are expressed in the big book, came about because it was the input of a good many people in this. There's a bit of English history that's significant in that point, I believe, is if you haven't read John Stuart Mill's essay on liberty, read it again. Because he says that the more different people are looking at the same idea and will express themselves honestly about it, the closer you're coming to the truth. And this, in my judgment, is why the big book is so solid. And we're fortunate that Bill functioned that way, and he had the ability that he had to express things clearly. He had an unusual, in my judgment, an unusual command of the English language. Bernard Smith, who helped Bill develop the structure of AA as we know it today. Bernard Smith, international lawyer, understood the importance of structure understood the importance of being clear in our relationships with each other within the fellowship. Clear as the literature began to develop, as there began to be necessary relationships with the legal structure of the country, so that we have the three phases of the General Service Office: the publishing operation, the grapevine, separate and yet wholly owned, and the General Service Board, Board of Trustees, which has the basic, the fundamental last authority. And yet, as the General Service Board developed over the years from a majority of non-alcoholics to now a majority of alcoholics, this came slowly. And yet we have a structure, and I use the word structure rather than organization. It's hard for me to think of AA as an organization. It's so permissive, so loosely organized. And yet structure is important if we're going to continue. And Bernard Smith was the architect of the structure, along with Bill. Dr. Harry Thiebaud, who was the first psychiatrist to understand the mechanics of recovery, to understand the importance of surrender and what this amounted to, and the distinction between surrender and submission. Most of us, I think, when we first come into AA, are submissive. We're there because we're being pushed in, not there because we want to be. I remember the time that my sponsor in AA, and I may have time to tell you a little bit about him. I remember the time he came into the office several months after he had accepted AA, and he looked entirely different. He was relaxed. I could tell that something had happened to him, as he had really surrendered. And many, many people in AA can remember the two dates, the date of their last drink and the date when they surrendered. And many of us who have tried to help alcoholics and are working with them sense a difference in the way people look when they come in through the door, because they aren't fighting anymore. They've taken the first step in AA. Dr. Thiebaud was a tremendous help when we were going through some struggles at GSO and the Board of Trustees. He was a great help in keeping us from going off on tangents. Marty Mann. If it hadn't been for Marty, many of us wouldn't be here. And yet, as you know, Marty was a storm center. I don't know whether she ever admitted or ever broke her anonymity, really. Whether she ever said in public that she was a member of AA outside of an AA meeting. She may well not have. But she was pilloried, criticized, because it was assumed that she had broken her anonymity. But if she hadn't been the kind of person that she was, if she hadn't had the courage to stand up and all over the world say that alcoholism is a disease and the alcoholic a sick person, that the alcoholic can be helped and is worth helping, that alcoholism as a public health problem and a public health responsibility. Many people who are alive and happy in AA today would either be dead or still suffering. We would still be in AA. We would still be trying to help people get well, get over their acute intoxication in our homes without benefit of the kind of help that is often necessary if lives are going to be saved. And back when I first became involved with alcoholism and with AA, no hospital in Rochester would accept an alcoholic under that diagnosis. And the only place where they could be taken care of, would be accepted, was the county infirmary, the psychiatric ward, where we could get people in under a police commitment, and one nursing home that would accept them with a fairly high price tag. Even though we're having problems today, there are many fewer problems than they had back in those days. So many other people along the line that have brought their wisdom, their experience, at a time when it was needed. I'm thinking of the man who was the first AA member in Finland, Veikko. Veikko got his AA by correspondence from California, from a Finnish friend who happened to be there, who had gotten into AA, who knew that Veikko was in trouble. And there are now in Finland some 3,000 members of AA. Finland is the only place I know of where they really know how many members there are. They keep attendance by name at the meetings. So that figure is high, is accurate. Veikko is known as Columbus, spelled with a K in Finland.